Hello, everyone. This is the Gain podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer. Thank you so much for joining us in what is a very difficult time for everyone. We are continuing to social distance here on the podcast. So in East London, it's Gregor Robertson who joins us, as does Matt Dickinson from Southwest London. Matt and Gregor, how are you both doing? Matt, how are you doing first?
I'm staying sane, but then I keep having to remind myself I'm about a week into this. Trying to stay active, trying to keep level-headed.
When you say keep active, what are you doing?
The last thing I bought before lockdown started were a couple of dumbbells. I've got two teenage sons who are got a lot of energy to burn off. So we're trying to have a little family weight session a day. I don't think there's any danger of me turning into Arnold Schwarzenegger, but at least it gives us a little something to do, a bit of focus to the day. And I just think these, you know, you got to take what you can out of these things. And I'm doing something with my kids that I wasn't doing, you know, 2 weeks ago, and we've never done before. So take the little gains where you can, I say.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you're aware of this, Matt, but Gregor has enlisted himself in a press-up challenge. So the question is, Gregor, how are you getting on?
I really wish you weren't going to ask me that. I'm slacking. I'm slacking. I mean, if I tell you that I ordered a cocktail-making set at the weekend, that probably tells you how well my fitness regime has gone since we last spoke. Matt, we also have to discuss Matt's son's Keepy Uppy toilet roll challenge. It's an overhead kick on a trampoline off the backboard of a basketball net and in. No one, you can try that. You can do that again in a million years. Incredible.
I can do it once in a million years, and he certainly couldn't. I think he would struggle to repeat. Someone wisely said, someone had noticed on the video, said, it looks like it's getting dark on your video. And I it's no word of a lie. I had said to him, oddly enough, it wasn't his first attempt. And I had literally just said to him, look, it's starting to get dark and I need my tea. So, you know, you've got a couple more efforts. And lobbed up the bog roll to him. And As he was tracking it by the minute, he's up to about 250,000 views on Twitter now. So, as you say, you got to take the in these strange times, you got to take the pleasures where you can. And I have to say, it was one of those just lovely moments where you're prattling about in the garden, and suddenly you can feel like Pele, Rooney, and whoever. So yes, even with a toilet roll.
Oh, we'll have to look out for that if you haven't seen it then on social media. But coming up, we will tell you which Premier League superstar Sunday Times columnist Graham Souness says would be a doddle to play against. And we are discussing the famous I was there moments in sports, which you've been sending your tweets in for. So plenty to come on this podcast right after this.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, Harry Kane says the Premier League season should be scrapped if it cannot be completed by the end of June. All elite football in England is, of course, suspended until at least the 30th of April because of this coronavirus pandemic. But Kane has echoed the thoughts of the UEFA president, Alexander Seferin, who said on Saturday the season will probably be lost if it cannot restart before the end of June. Kane has added his thought into it. He said this, I know the Premier League will do everything it can to finish the season. There needs to be a point where enough is enough. Probably the limit for me is the end of June. So Kane is coming up with a cut-off point of the end of June for the Premier League season to get things underway. Gregor, do you think that's right? Is the end of June realistic?
No, I mean, personally, that looks pretty unlikely at the moment. So I think to the kind of possibility of naming a date like that at this moment in time is a bit hasty. Mm. I'm quite torn on this, actually. I was very much in the camp of it needs to be finished. The season must be finished, whenever that may be. But I think there's just so many unknowns. I understand, like, the biggest issue is really is a business one at this moment in time, and that I think, as Martin Ziegler wrote in the Times today, there's 750 million reasons why it needs to be finished, because of the broadcast money. But I just think we don't know how long this is going to go on for. We're not at the peak in this country of the pandemic, and we're kind of learning more and more every day and every week. And I know this is a football podcast, but I think what happens in the coming weeks about testing, whether that be for the virus or immunity, could change a lot, you know. And I think also the public appetite change. If 6 months is a long time, if we kick this into the long grass, I don't know what the kind of the appetite from the public is going to be, whether to finish the season or not. So I think at the moment it's too hasty to name a date. And as I say, I was very much in the camp of the season has to be finished. But the more and more I think about it, and the longer this goes on, I think people's opinion on that could change. I just think that naming a date at the moment is too soon.
Mm. Matt, do you think Harry Kane would be saying this if he was playing for Liverpool?
Yeah, good question. I mean, we've seen, you know, there are undoubtedly self-interest comes into these debates. We saw that obviously with Karen Brady right at the start, in a not very admirable way, I don't think. I can understand that there's going to be a whole range of views on this, but I tend to agree with Graham. I mean, my gut instinct is that, you know, not just for the financial reasons that we all know about, the 750 million that's potentially at stake, I think for integrity reasons, even more than that, it would be absolutely the best thing if this season was finished. And I'm willing to go beyond June if that can happen. I don't think there needs to be any... I think there shouldn't be a deadline put on that, certainly at the moment. I see Martin Ziegler, as we just mentioned, you know, Seferin's already pushing back to potentially August on that. I think that, you know, we have to keep an open mind, and, you know, we certainly have to look at any possibility of finishing this season if we can. Now, maybe it'll get to a point where it seems either impractical or, you know, just seems wrong. I don't think we're anywhere near that now.
Does that mean then we have to consider next season as well, and what any implications we'll have on that when we decide whether or not this season needs to be finished, Matt?
Well, it's a lot easier, obviously, to redraft, you know, say we do try and finish this season, and say it doesn't get finished till the autumn into September, then obviously it's a lot easier to redraft, you know, certainly in terms of an integrity issue, it's a lot easier to say, okay, how long have we got left? What window do we have? How do we compress competitions? How do we change a league structure to make it work? You know, how many games can we fit in? Which competitions? That's a heck of a lot of a, you know, easier decision to make from a position of right. You know, we know the time limit. We know what we've got to fit in and how we best going to do it. I'm not saying again that's going to be easy, but that I do think that, you know, we are very deep into the season, and an awful lot of, you know, effort and has gone into it. An awful lot of people invested a lot of, you know, hard work and emotion and so on into it. And when you are, you know, in that position, say, I think, you know, I think integrity, you know, matters to me obviously more than money. I know chief execs and chairman would be thinking otherwise, but I do just think that, you know, every chance of finishing this season has to be left open.
Mm. Well, a lot of brains are coming together to come up with different ideas of how we could possibly finish this season. One proposed plan is to isolate Premier League teams in World Cup style camps in London and the Midlands in order to play behind closed doors games in quick succession to get the season finished. Do you think that's feasible, Gregor?
I think at the moment, again, it sounds pretty bizarre, to be honest. I think there's so again, there's so many unknowns. It feels like if one case of coronavirus within, you know, even in one team would shut the entire thing down. Because it's not like picking up an injury. This is a global pandemic, and you can take, you know, people can take all the care and precaution in the world to try and isolate the players and the staff and whatnot. But it only takes one little misstep or one bit of bad luck for someone to come down with it, and then that's it closed down. So I think it's an idea that it reeks a little bit of the kind of the desperation, I think, and the sort of self-importance of football that's been illuminated at the moment. There, I think we will need to kind of take a bit of a deep breath and understand that there's not an easy solution at the moment, and we need to see what comes in the next few weeks.
Matt, obviously everybody is missing football right now, and a football mega feast like this sort of World Cup style camp for the Premier League to be finalised would give everybody that fix that they need. But would it morally be right for us to even think about doing something like this when we're in this period of isolation still?
Well, I mean, I can't, you know, you can't blame the football clubs authorities for exploring all options behind the scenes. But, I think I wrote something last week about sport having to know its place. And, you know, certainly for the next, you know, couple of months, you know, the idea that any single resource that could be better used to fight this virus would go towards sport would be morally wrong. You know, I mean, clearly the idea that, you know, a single ambulance or single policeman might, you know, be asked to sort of help stage a football match when, you know, there is so much else to preoccupy us. That can't happen any time. But yeah, I mean, clearly, but, you know, behind the scenes, I expect there, well, I don't suspect, we know that there are all sorts of talks going on, and, you know, there are jobs to save in football as there are in other sectors. But I just think when it comes to staging matches, getting competitions back on the road, you know, I wrote this to say not just about football, but the Tour de France and the Open Championship. These are decisions that ultimately are going to need to be taken by government in league with senior health officials, not by sports bodies, because, you know, this is going to be a matter of, you know, what is good for the public. You know, having sport back on the telly, yes, that would be lovely. But this is the type of decision that needs to be taken on public health grounds.
I mean, what would happen to the leagues below? This is not going. They're not going to do this for every league. They're not going to do it for League Two per se. These leagues can't afford to play games behind doors, even if that was an option. So I mean, it's a little bit murky, this. I think if the Premier League goes and kind of keeps its house in order and finishes the season in quick sharp time, gets the broadcast money in its coffers. Are we looking at seasons out of tandem in this country now, going forward? So, you know, I think there's a lot of question marks over that.
Gregor, just let me ask you then, from a footballing side of things, mentally, how do you think players would cope in a situation like this? Yes, a lot of them will have played at World Cups and Euros, so they'll understand that tournament experience, but a lot wouldn't have. And although they will take the strictest measures by ensuring all the players, all the officials, all the broadcasters involved will have gone through the right tests, mentally, do you think they'll be in the right state of mind to play a tournament like this? Bear in mind that their family, they won't be seeing their family. They won't know what's happening necessarily if their family are unwell. All these things that need to be taken into account.
Well, yeah, that's an excellent point. I think, you know, if someone in your family came down with this in the middle of what is essentially would be a mini tournament, that leaves someone with a pretty tough decision to make. And look, this is football at the end of the day, so I don't think it really would be a decision to be made. Somebody would to lose a player, and these aren't necessarily unlikely scenarios. So it's fraught with difficulties, keeping so many people isolated from the rest of the country, essentially. And there would be a value to it. There's no doubt, having something to take our minds off everything that's going on and watch the football, there would be a value to it. But I don't know whether really kind of it can be done on a sort of logistical level.
I know, having spoken to Danny Murphy on this subject earlier on today, he was quite in favour, thinking it's quite doable. But I do wonder if that is his Liverpool fan head that's speaking more on this than anything else. Let's move it on then. In the Sunday Times, Graham Souness is the subject of Ask the Columnist this week, where he tackles all manner of questions on his football career, both on and off the field. But one question that was put to Souness was this: much has been made of your apparent disdain for Paul Pogba. Is this a misconception? What words of advice do you feel that you would have offered him? And this was Souness's response. Pogba has absolutely everything to be a top player. Great athleticism, super technique, but his attitude to the game is the polar opposite of mine. He goes out with one thought in his mind: I'm going to show everyone how clever I am today and be the star of the show. My attitude, the way I was taught, was go out and work harder than the guy you're in against and see where that takes you. He'd be an absolute doddle to play against. Matt, what did you make of Souness's comments?
I saw someone's response, which did make me chuckle, which is sort of saying, you know, the world can come to an absolute, you know, standstill and we can be in complete crisis, but one thing stays absolutely unbending and unwavering, and that is Souness's dislike of Paul Pogba. You know, we need some certainties in life at the moment, and this certainly seems to be one of them. I think Graham's a very blunt commentator. I get a bit of what he's on about, but I equally think it can be overstated, and I do think Paul Pogba, his attention, as we know, has not been as on the day job as it might have been at Manchester United in recent months. He, you know, there's been, you know, obviously his agent's been kicking off. They've been looking at exit options. You know, it's not been a particularly good stance from him or his camp. But the idea that he's, you know, sort of someone that Souness would take the mickey out of in midfield, I do struggle at. I mean, let's, you know, when Pogba is at his best, as he was at Juventus when he was winning, you know, multiple honours alongside Pirlo, when he was playing for France and being one of the best players in a World Cup winning team, then he didn't look any, you know, midfield fool to me. So I'm sure Graham would have left a few marks on him.
Gregor, where do you stand then on the whole Pogba debate? Do you think Souness is right, or do you actually think he's been slightly disrespectful?
I think there's an element of truth to what he's saying. I think there's a kind of conflict in Pogba between the team, as Souness is sort of alluding to, between, even if it's even sort of moments on the pitch, little decision-making moments on the pitch, between what is the best thing to do to help this team to win and what kind of is part of showcasing my extreme talent. And look, there's other players, lots of other players in the world that are like that. But Pogba is not a Neymar or a Messi or a live winger or even really a number 10. And I think people like Souness and also people of his kind of generation, they see someone who has absolutely all the attributes in his locker to be a proper box-to-box midfielder, someone who dominates games. They don't see that, and I think they desperately do want to see that. So that's kind of, I think that's at the root of Souness's kind of unbending, as Matt said, unbending criticism of Pogba. The idea that he'd be a doddle to play against, I'm not so sure. an idea even that Souness went out on the pitch always to just simply work harder than the other guy. I think, as Matt said, he left a few tackles sort of don't help his argument that he always did the best thing for the team. Pogba, Manchester United are a better team with Pogba in it. The arrival of Fernandes kind of has changed perceptions of that a little bit, but they're a better team with him in it. On the other hand, I feel that there's just a little bit too much water under the bridge now, and as Matt's saying there, there's so much noise around him, so much noise from him and his agent, that I'd be amazed if he doesn't leave Manchester United very soon and they don't recoup some of the money and reinvest it where they need it.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify.
Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no,
so
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Okay, well, we're going to finish today's podcast with a look at some of sport's most jaw-dropping moments. And Matt has been writing about some of sport's biggest moments that he was lucky enough to report on live. Now, they don't have to be glorious moments. They can be sentimental or, of course, even moments of utter despair. I'm going to ask the panel for their top three I was there moments. And Matt, why don't you kick things off for us? Because some people may not, ashamedly, may not have read your piece in the Times. But what were your top three moments?
Well, if we're talking, this is a football blog, so I mean, I actually had a goal for, in terms of sort of jaw-dropping days of sport I've covered. I actually did a piece on Jean van der Velde blowing the open in 99, which, it was just one. I watched the tape back and was still sort of watching it with my head in my hands, going, you know, don't do it. But if I'm going to talk about 99 and talk about football, then I would say that the top football one on my list, for very obvious reasons, was being at the Nou Camp to watch culmination of a treble to win the Champions League that way after the season they'd had with so many extraordinary roller coaster games. You know, the league title went to the last day of the season. It was, you know, mind-blowing run of dramatic matches and, you know, football bloody hell at the end. So, I mean, that would be top of my football list. But, you know, when I was flicking through this, there are so many. You know, 1998, I was there to watch Michael Owen's wonder goal against Argentina, which was, you know, I've never seen a press box react the same way. I know we're meant to be partisan, but it was, you know, genuinely there were sort of people looking at each other in, and well, more than looking, jumping around in a sort of, you know, not because it was sort of England, we scored a goal, just in general wonder at the nature of the goal, and that was an epic match. Zidane's headbutt would have to be super high up there because, again, you know, if this is about moments where you can't believe what you're seeing, then that is right there. To be doing it in your last ever game of football, a World Cup final, you know, you've got the chance to be the, you know, to finish this incredible career. What a one of the greatest players I've ever seen. And, you know, you've got this chance to bow out in style and you end up, you know, getting the red card in those circumstances. So, yes, there was that. I'd say football wise, those are right up there. But I could probably talk for the next half hour.
But mentioning that Zidane headbutt, did you actually see it? Or did you have to see the replays to kind of get what had happened?
It was one of those ones I saw something but didn't see it, if you know what I mean. You sort of glance something and just sort of, I wasn't focused on it. I saw a sort of coming together, and by the time I'd sort of, you know, realised that's where my gaze needed to be, it happened. So I did need to see a replay to, I was probably a bit like the ref who, you know, there's the famous sort of rumour, pretty well substantiated rumour around that it took the fourth official to clock it properly on a monitor and say, look, you know, you need to take action, because it wasn't really anywhere that anyone would have been focusing at that time. It wasn't, you know, they weren't jostling over the ball or anything. It was very much off the ball. So, the minute you saw it back on the replay, it was just remarkable in every respect. And to be on that scale in your final football match almost felt unfathomable. Fun. I might even be able to say it once. Unfathomable.
Oh, we'll say it was a technical glitch, Matt. That's why we couldn't understand that
yeah,
last
exactly.
word. But it certainly was a jaw-dropping moment. Gregor, what about your top three?
I mean, Matt's going to knock me out of the park with his ones there. So the bit, I think my first one has to be, I was at the game when Dennis Bergkamp scored that goal for Arsenal against Newcastle United at St James's Park in 2002. where Robert Pires fired the ball into him and he absolutely bamboozled, I think it was Dabizas, the Newcastle defender, left foot touch around him and turn and pirouetted around him the other way to gather the ball. He's kind of passed to himself. So that, I think that was my first. Jermaine Genius had just, I was at Nottingham Forest at the time, and Jermaine Genius had just signed for Newcastle. So he got myself and two other guys from, we were in the kind of in the academy at that time. He got us some tickets, and I just remember being sat beside a guy called Craig Westgar, and he just burst out laughing. We were sitting among the Newcastle fans, and he just burst out laughing. He couldn't control his. His emotions at seeing that firsthand, it was remarkable.
Gregor, you say I'm going to knock you out of the park. I'm now incredibly jealous of you because I did write a piece once and said that is my favourite touch of a football ever. And, you know, I've seen a few. And I just think Bergkamp was absolutely one of my heroes in, you know, just in, I mean, not as an Arsenal fan, but I just, one of those players I was absolutely drawn to. Fascinating character. I interviewed him once, went over to Ajax to interview him, and the question I couldn't wait to ask more than any was about that goal and how he saw it and, you know, what he was thinking and what he was trying to do. So I say my list isn't bad, but I'm afraid I'm now going to spend the rest of the day thinking, you know, jammy Gregor.
Well, that's as good as it gets. They get sort of definitely washed from here. My next one would be my first Old Firm game, actually, which was in 1996, so I would have been 12. And it was just the most thrilling, eye-opening spectacle and game of football I'd ever witnessed. Pier van Hooijdonk and Gazza both missed penalties. Brian Laudrup scored the winner for Rangers. And Peter van Vossen, I don't know if any of you remember, he regularly gets voted as the worst sitter of all time. I think Brian Laudrup rolled the ball across the six-yard box to him and he scooped it over the bar, kind of with no one around him and the goal at his mercy. And Tommy Burns, the manager, got sent off. There was, kind of, you know, bookends and challenges galore. Paolo Di Canio was playing. It was just one of those games that you kind of, I think that's where you really, as a 12-year-old, you go to a game like that and you think, I want nothing more than to be a part of that. So that stands out in my memory. Absolutely. And then the last one has to be kind of A, because I've not been to many other sort of big events like that. But I think it has to be the first time I walked out at Wembley, because I'd played for teams that had reached Wembley finals twice before and been injured in the weeks running up to them. So I thought I had kind of some kind of curse hanging above me when it comes to playing at Wembley. And I played in a playoff final in the National League against Bristol Rovers in 2015, and there was 50,000 fans there. And walking out, I just had the biggest smile on my face that I've ever had, thinking that, thank God, I've reached this, finally walked out onto this pitch to play football. And no matter what happens from there, I knew that I would enjoy the day, and I did, even though we lost.
Nice. See, it's nice because you could make it about yourself. And that was, I like that. I like that, Gregor. Obviously, you're all wrong because you weren't at the Brentford Doncaster game a few seasons ago. And obviously, it was a case of whoever got a positive result out of that one went up. I was there to see Brentford awarded that last minute penalty, which we thought, and I genuinely thought, because I'm not the most optimistic when it comes to penalties, but I genuinely thought a 90th minute penalty, we are going to score this and we are going to be promoted to the Championship. As it was, we know that two of our players argued about who should take the penalty. In the end, Marcello Trotta decided he was going to take it. And obviously, he hit the crossbar. Doncaster were able to pick up the ball, ran down the other end of the pitch. They scored. They went up. And so we had to spend another season in League One. But obviously, when we think about it now, we probably benefited from it because we went up the following season in the automatic promotion spots. But anyway, plenty have been getting involved because we asked this question on Twitter and loads of people got in touch. This is from David Langley. He says, I was there when Mark Viduka smashed four past Liverpool. It was the best match I ever witnessed. 4-3 Leeds. It was in the end after being 2-0 down. Jim Shondell says, Chelsea trailing Liverpool 2-0 at half time in the FA Cup at Stamford Bridge in 1997. sub-zero conditions, couldn't feel my feet and was miserable as we seemingly never beat them, but we turned it around 4-2 and went on to lift the trophy that season. That was simply magic. David Littlewood mentions the 1969 Intercities Fairs Cup final first leg with Newcastle 3-0 up in that one, and they went on to win that 6-2 on aggregate. That's the last major piece of silverware. And the tweet got some of our Times colleagues talking. James Restall, he's gone for Chelsea 6, Arsenal 0. The mistaken identity red card. Stamford Bridge chanting specialist in failure at Wenger on his 1,000th game. And a rare goal for Mo Salah as well back then. Molly Hudson has gone for the USA lifting the Women's World Cup trophy in 2019 in front of 57,000 fans who are all chanting for equal pay. There you go. Plenty have got in touch with their moments. Let me just pass on my thanks to Gregor and Matt for joining us. You may find yourself with a bit more time on your hands in the coming week, so do remember you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. All you have to do is search The Times subscription for more information. And we will be back this Thursday for The Game podcast. Stay safe in the meantime.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.